All right. Thank you, everyone, for coming to this post-lunch panel. We'll try and be cogent. And if you're going to snore out there, please do it quietly. Not heard yet? All right. I was trying to modulate my booming voice.
Turn them on.
All right. Didn't want to jar people after lunch. No. So I hope, I'm sure we'll have a very engaging panel here about what has been called a comparative effectiveness and reimbursement. Are we setting the bar sufficiently high? From proof of concept to Ed's term, proof of relevance. We have some very distinguished guests here with three very different perspectives from kind of clinical oncologists, academia, Medco, payer, and from a large pharma company, Sanofi. The disclaimer is I am not an expert in comparative effectiveness or in market access issues. We have a strategic partner for that who's in the audience if you want to find Paul Gallagher. But what we do think about that is germane to the issue all the time and what our clients are struggling with is how is a drug going to differentiate itself in what is increasingly a very highly competitive space where, notwithstanding perhaps the target and molecular segmentation of the patients creating a situation where maybe you have a unique matchup of drug and diagnostics and patient that maybe has some degree of protection from competition, but still to a great degree many of the drugs are going to be used in a variety of patients, and there are a lot of follow-ons to almost every given mechanism. And so how one thinks about what's the benchmark? What's the minimally accepted target product profile? And that's made up of various elements of how much improvement in efficacy do we have to have that's going to be meaningful to clinicians. Increasingly, one also has to think about what is going to be the benefit that's going to be sufficiently attractive to payers and how does that translate to pricing. And all of this in the context of, as I said, increasing competition in the space. And so being able to think about these issues and what are the various parameters that go into that, the idea of measuring effectiveness, whether it's comparative, ultimately, you know, oncology has always been about data, but increasingly you're needing to think about what are the outcomes, what are the endpoints, what's the quality of life, and what is going to be meaningful to those doctors, to those patients, but also to the payers. And, of course, the regulatory agency is a given here. So I'm going to let each of the panelists give an introduction and perhaps give us a brief orientation of their perspective in this space, and then we will begin with our panel. And certainly at any point, if anyone has any questions, please chime in. So.
Okay. Hi, good afternoon. My name is Deb Schrag, and I do two things. I'm a physician at an academic medical center, and I will confess to having never practiced in the real world. I've exclusively practiced at large academic medical centers. Spent about a decade here in New York at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and for about the past 5 years, I've been at Dana-Farber Harvard Medical School. So, you know, these are big institutions that use lots of these drugs. With respect to research, I have been doing comparative effectiveness research for over 15 years, including before anyone ever heard of the term or called it that. It's more commonly called health services research. So I'm going to try to make a couple of remarks that will hopefully sort of frame things. I think the key insight for folks who manufacture drugs or market products in the oncology space is to really think about the distinction between efficacy and effectiveness. Now, it's not a simple dichotomy, this or that, but really it's about two distinct questions. Typically, an efficacy study is asking the question, how well can this work? And it involves carefully controlled experiments that select an ideal population of patients who are going to be compliant, who are going to be very closely supervised to figure out what the potential impact of a product could be essentially under ideal conditions. Effectiveness is asking a different question. How well does this treatment work when it's given under normal circumstances? Anyone who's ever tried to swallow a week of antibiotics knows that taking pills four times a day is challenging. I suspect everyone in the room has always taken every single pill, but people other than people who attend these conferences don't necessarily take all of their pills four times a day every 6 hours. And really, it's about trying to understand the difference between efficacy and effectiveness that has really caught on and garnered more attention, I think, both from the payers as well as from providers. Now, obviously, it's not a neat dichotomy, but I think it used to be that once you had FDA approval, once you'd proven efficacy, because that's what the FDA looks at, efficacy, you were done. And now increasingly the bar is moving to include systematic ongoing evaluation of effectiveness. How do you do that? It's messy. We don't have large randomized controlled trials of effectiveness. It involves grubbing and mining through messy data sets. It's gotten a little easy with the proliferation of electronic medical records, but folks are now looking at effectiveness data post-approval. This is known to many folks as phase four trials, which were always sort of a part of the, you know, regulatory process. And a lot of comparative effectiveness research is, in essence, phase four studies. It's just that we all know that phase four studies were not routinely conducted or carried out. And I think we're seeing greater emphasis on this from the academic community as well as the payers, led, I think, a great deal by the public payers, Medicare. And, you know, I would urge you to focus on activities of PCORI, the new federal initiative, and the AHRQ, which are really heavily engaged in this space. And later on in the panel, I'll make some more specific comments about how academic medical centers are trying to stay ahead of this wave.
Hi, I'm Brian DiCaro. I think a lot of you met me yesterday on the panel on data. So today I'm on the panel to represent reimbursement. My actual area of focus at Medco is not necessarily on reimbursement for drugs. My focus is actually on reimbursement for diagnostics, which, as we all know right now, is there's a lot of companion diagnostics in oncology. But I can also answer a lot of questions regarding how we're actually looking at oncology. I think I'll wait for a lot of the questions and just field questions from yourselves about reimbursement, but I'll tell you some of the changing paradigms in the area of oncology and what payers' focuses are as well. I think I made a little bit of comments yesterday where I was stating that payers' focus is on where the money is being spent. So a lot of our efforts go into areas that are not oncology because traditionally oncology, as I said yesterday, is an area of acute spend, high and acute spend, but actually when you look at spend, what drives spend is not incidence, but prevalence of disease. And therefore, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, psychiatric diseases are diseases that you may get when you're very young and that you live with for the next 50, 60 years, and therefore their contribution to spend far outweighs what the spend is in oncology. And if you saw our drug trend report from Medco last year, what you would see is that oncology is the eighth therapeutic area when it comes to spend. So it's far down the list of focus. But what I would say is that we heard yesterday that, you know, several years ago there weren't very many options on the table for patients with various oncology indications. And today that's changed. There's been a lot of great drugs from yourselves that have made it to the market that are really improving patient outcomes. And now there's a lot of options for physicians about which drugs to actually provide to the patients. There's a lot of off-label use of these medications as well, often driven by the diagnostics that I'm very interested in. So there's a dichotomy I can talk a little bit about on both of internally in our businesses. But with more and more drugs coming to the market, now there's actually new pressures and options that we can actually now have tiered formulary structures, which I'll talk about. We also have new prior authorizations where before, really, if a physician decided that they wanted to order a particular drug for a patient, it just got reimbursed. And it was more costly to actually put in place a prior authorization program than it was to actually just say yes to whatever that choice was for end-of-life care. Now that's changed. Now there's multiple options. So we're moving more towards tiered structures, preferred formularies, prior authorizations, both from the drug itself and the indication, but also we have just recently put in prior authorizations around the diagnostics that go with the drug. So this year, or last year, I guess it is now, we put in place prior authorizations for Zelbraf and Zelcori, where we actually call the physician and actually have them send us the test results from the test before we'll actually allow the drug to be administered to the patient so that the appropriate patients are getting the drug. And I think that's what's really important is in the discussions that pharma has with us around pricing, definitely molecular-based medicines get a higher price because they're targeted to the patients that are going to benefit. We appreciate that, and that's why the drugs are priced at a higher reimbursement rate. But at that same time, we want to therefore make sure that the right patients are getting it because that's how we actually evaluated the value of that program. And so if a lot of patients are receiving the drug and the test has not been done, then that will go against the pricing that we've all negotiated. So there's a lot of things that we can talk about on the panel. I can go into greater details of some of the issues that we have with the buy and bill system currently and how that is a challenge that we're it's a challenge on how it's coding. It's a challenge on how we see the data, but it's also a big focus of how we're going to start changing the incentives on the buy and bill so that we're really focused on patient outcomes and comparative effectiveness and not on how much money you make on the drug that you're buying in and then billing later on. So I'll talk about a lot of these things on the panel today. Thanks.
Thank you. My name is Usman Iqbal. I head the Oncology Global Evidence and Value Development in Sanofi. So within that role, we just do health economics and outcomes research, but also we're responsible for translating all the evidence, whether it's preclinical to clinical, as well as health economic and outcome, and basically articulating a value proposition and putting all the information into a core value dossier that could be effectively used for all the stakeholders, let it be the patient, the provider, or the payers. So that's what our function is, and comparative effectiveness is something that we do on a regular basis for our products. And I think Deborah and Brian have touched upon the real good aspects that we're going to be dealing with comparative effectiveness. I would just like to add a couple of key issues, what I've been listening so far. As Deborah pointed out, the issue of efficacy versus effectiveness. I think one thing to note, which is very important, is that the clinical trials are driven through a very specific protocol-driven environment. It has very selected subpopulations. When our drug actually goes into the real world, because we're responsible for monitoring that, and we do that very effectively through real world and databases, EMRs, and all of that stuff. It's when the drug is operating in the real world, it is operating at a very different level, and we need more information than just survival to make best and informed judgment about how these drugs are operating and how we can do effectively the comparative effectiveness aspect. So we've been talking about that since yesterday, and all we've talked about is survival. I think one point that I want to make very clear is that it's beyond survival. Cancer care has gone beyond survival. Europeans have totally gone advanced in that aspect. It's important that we capture other core clinical as well as economic outcomes. And by that, I mean health-related quality of life and patient-reported outcomes. In this new era of patient centricity, it's really, really important that we bring the patient perspective into the clinical trials. Yes, we know we extended the life for about 2 or 3 months, but how did the patient have the experience in all of that? Yes, we have the symptom index, but how did that symptom affect the patient's quality of life, their role functioning, their social functioning, their mental health? All of that information is very, very important to make informed and defined judgment about the drug's effectiveness. The Europeans actually, in their HTA assessments, don't talk about survival. They talk about a very specific index. It's called quality-adjusted life years. It's a formula where you combine the quality, the health-related quality of life with the survival data, and you come up with a quality-adjusted life year. So supposedly you extend the survival for 3 months, but your quality index was 0.7, your overall quality-adjusted survival would not be 3 months. It would be about 2 months, something however you multiply it. So your quality-adjusted life year would depend on the impact of quality of life. If your drug didn't improve the quality of life, or the scores remain stable, that has an impact on the final outcome. And in every HTA assessment in Europe, Australia, Canada, as well as other major markets, that's how the drug is assessed. It's not just survival, it's about health-related quality of life. Second, Brian talked about the the actual acute implication of cancer, and that's why it's really important while we're designing our trials. The other information is the economic endpoint, hospitalizations, health resource utilization, because at the end of the day, if you're having an impact on progression-free survival, theoretically or hypothetically, you should have an impact on whether you're reducing hospitalizations and the care around the product. So, and that is the kind of endpoint that is not just relevant to the payers, but also to the patients as well as the providers. And that's a multi-stakeholder decision criteria analysis that is really, really important. So, 2 points: the outcomes of cancer and the cancer care are not limited to just survival. They have to include quality of life in the patient perspective, as well as the economic endpoints for resource planning. And that's what the Europeans are doing, and that's how they base their health technology assessment principles on. It's a fundamental principle which has not gone in the U.S. It's changing with institutes like PCORI and all of that. So in the future, what we're going to see is a very different profile where you won't be able to get away from either from a regulatory perspective or from a payer perspective with just survival data. So that's one point. And another thing that I just quickly wanted to point out was we talked a lot about the combinations, the novel combination and all of that. It's important that we're able to do these sequential analysis and see how the add-on therapies are impacting patient outcome, then are we able to get better benefits out of that. But also we need to make sure we don't end up with a diminishing rate of return when it comes to these next generation biologics. Because when you're combining these expensive biologics, you need to make sure that you're setting the efficacy threshold, the bar, really, really high for a payer to be remotely interested in paying for 3 drugs per patient rather than just 1 drug. And that's really, really important. The clinical and the science translation component is important, but from a theoretical, from a holistical, as well as from an intuitive standpoint, also keep in mind that at the end of the day, someone has to pay for that, the patient or the payer at the end of the day. And the way the future is coming, both would have to take the share of that. And if your drug is working with three agents in one patient, the efficacy threshold, you better give, it's not about a few weeks. We're talking months and years for a payer to be remotely interested in being able to agree to pay for that, which is happening. And that has happened in Europe, where they have outrightly refused to cover products. These are the targeted agents, the biologics. Avastin, I'm not sure if folks know, is not covered by NICE, the health technology assessment evaluation in UK. They have rejected NICE, Erbitux, as well as Vectibix. So in England, you cannot really, patients don't have access to Avastin. So there was a lot of political hue and cry that was created, and then the UK government had to come up with a cancer drug fund. It's a £200 million cancer drug fund budget where the government would pay for these high-priced cancer products because the health technology assessment refused to do that. So the day is not far where you'll see that in big major markets, and then in the U.S. with the continuing payer pressures, you're going to see that. So science translation component is important, but at the same time, it's important to realize the level of threshold that would be necessary to create an impact at the payer and the provider level. Rest, I think there are some methodological aspects that we need to touch base upon in terms of comparative effectiveness, because one thing that within oncology specific is the huge amount of heterogeneity in terms of the patient population as well as the treatment paradigm that really, really limits us from a methodological standpoint to do comparative effectiveness. The good news is that we're making progress. Agencies like AHRQ and NCCN, they have taken the lead. Certain effectiveness guidance documents have come out. AHRQ just released an effective guidance document in 2009 on early prostate cancer and head and neck cancer. That was up for comments for the public view and for experts for a good 6 months. NCCN came up with the comparative therapeutic index, which provides you an effectiveness versus toxicity ratio for any product for each cancer. That again was it's called CTI, and that was available for comment for for the community, research community, as well as a clinician for 6 months. So one thing that I would really like to point out is for folks to keep track of these initiatives that are taken by these agencies and provide periodic and timely feedback, because that's important given the therapeutic area that we're dealing with, where we're dealing with a lot of heterogeneity, and how we can refine the methods around them to be able to quantify the comparative effectiveness. It's important that we get feedback, the expert feedback from the clinicians and all the stakeholders.
Anyone have any questions at this point before I toss the first question out? All right, Laura.
So my question is for Brian. You mentioned the prior authorization required for Zelboraf and Zelcori, and my question is actually about the diagnostic. Is the diagnostic considered a medical benefit or a pharmacy benefit, and how is it reimbursed?
So it's considered a medical benefit, and in fact, a lot of the therapeutics in oncology are considered a medical benefit because they actually are reimbursed through HCPCS codes, through medical claims, and not through the pharmacy claims. But I would say that the client base, so I represent the PBM, which is the pharmacy benefit. Our clients are the same clients that actually hire the health plans to be their medical benefit. And therefore, if there's things that we can do to help them control their costs on their medical benefit, they actually will still pay us or hire us to actually do that as well. Also, you know, specialty pharmacy is something that is a growing area that we focus on. At Accredo, which is part of Medco. So it's really a blurred line between medical benefit and pharmacy benefit. Currently, diagnostics are a medical benefit, but my focus at Medco is to actually make diagnostics a pharmacy benefit, and especially for the diagnostics that are making therapeutic decisions about which drugs to use, because that's controls the costs appropriately for what we're representing our clients for. The other thing is, I think that I'll just make a side note, which is that the way that diagnostics are reimbursed is problematic. It's around stacking procedure codes instead of a value-based reimbursement, which really decreases the incentive for investors and diagnostic companies to focus on high-value-based diagnostics. So in my organization at Medco, we actually partner with diagnostic companies to help them educate physicians, educate patients as patient advocates about the appropriate use of the diagnostic. We target patients using our data that actually if the diagnostic is appropriate for them. We make sure that they know it exists, that's part of their benefit, and then we actually reimburse it through the pharmacy plan as a value-based reimbursement with whatever cost we've negotiated with that diagnostic company, completely separate to the CPT code stacking that goes through the medical benefit. So we're trying to change the paradigm of how diagnostics are reimbursed.
To follow up on that, as we segment further and further tumor populations, and as we have more and more matching drugs, we are going to have to go to broader and broader diagnostic tests in order to capture the 5%, the 2%, the 1% that have that 95% chance of a cure. How much are you willing to reimburse for these diagnostic tests if we have to spend tens and tens of thousands of dollars to get the answer?
So I think we're willing to spend quite a lot of money on the diagnostic, because compared to the cost of the therapeutic, the diagnostic is still very, very inexpensive. This is the dichotomy I was just talking to about in the introduction, which is one side of the business I work in, we're sitting here saying we're not going to allow off-label use for medications. Also, if it's a second-line medication, we're not going to allow first-line medication use without having a dialogue with the physician first about why they're making that decision. Yet my organization, within the same organization at Medco, is trying to work with companies like Caris, Clarient, Genoptics, and other people who are doing broad-scale molecular profiling, including Foundation as well, with next-gen sequencing, because we believe that if you have the data up front in the patient's record, it's going to help make the appropriate decisions when they fail first line, when they fail second line. It's going to make the prior authorization a lot more efficient for us to already approve the drug without having to have the dialogue with the physician, because we already know that they're making a decision that's based upon the molecular basis of the tumor instead of having a dialogue about why we don't see anything and we don't know why they've made that decision. So we're But we're not going to just cover it just because it's good science and it's a good research tool. We have to cover it under an evidence-based determination. And so our model is to actually work with the diagnostic companies to help them, once they're on the commercial market and approved, we work with the physicians to get patients tested, typically at a cost to the diagnostic company, to kind of find where that best value is of implementing that broader-based diagnostic and close the gap in care. The other thing that we do a lot is we see, you know, in the marketplace right now, we see one-off testing. So if a physician wants to order Erbitux, they may order the KRAS test, but they don't order other tests that should actually be ordered for that same indication. And we think that the decision might be well informed by having more testing done for that particular indication. So we work with the physician to get more testing done if appropriately. It's always the physician's decision, but to be aware that there's other tests that might influence their therapeutic choice. So it's difficult because then I rub up against my own prior auth rules, but we actually have to work with our own company to say, to flag those patients about why they got that test and then to kind of turn off the prior authorization rules for that particular individual. But I think the knowledge up front is also going to save us. I know it's a long-winded answer, but one of the other problems that we have in oncology is that drugs are bought, they're utilized, and then they're billed for, and then that goes through the medical benefit, and then eventually we see that. We see that 4 months after the drug was utilized. So it's hard for us to actually put in the appropriate care and prior authorizations and get the diagnostics to be used at the time of the treatment decision if we're waiting for that treatment decision to already have occurred. So I think that offering larger scale testing up front allows us to have the data before treatment decision, where right now the drugs do not give us enough time to get ahead of the treatment decision.
Deborah, do you want to talk a little? I mean, we're on the call. We were talking about some of the issues with prior authorization and.
So I actually want to say a couple words, both about molecular profiling and about prior authorization. So, you know, the idea of bundling molecular diagnostics is terrific. On the one hand, you know, it would be great. Sort of an analogy would be, if you're doing an amniocentesis, you don't really want to profile chromosome 1 and then come back for another test of chromosome 2 and another test of chromosome 3. You want to say, look, we're looking for Down syndrome, but we're just going to profile all 23 chromosomes at the same time, even though mostly we're screening out Down syndrome and a couple other things that are rare as hen's teeth, right? The problem is right now we have such a parsimonious short list of molecular targets for which there is a drug. I mean, it is a short list. So from a payer's perspective, HER2-new, well, that changes care in breast cancer and gastric cancer. And KRAS definitely relates to whether or not it's appropriate to give cetuximab or panitumumab. But the list gets short, and it's, you know, I think it's one way to save money is to just do the parsimonious tests. On the other hand, then if you want to come back later on or you want to do something investigational, yes, you may want to do more profiling, but not everyone lives that long. So I think we don't know the economic answer. I think that once we have more molecular target drug pairs, the bundles will definitely make sense, but we're sort of in an interregnum period right now, and I don't think we know that doing the whole enormous profiling is necessarily the way to go just now. I mean, an example is KRAS testing. If you do KRAS testing and you find a KRAS mutation, which you will 30% of the time, there is absolutely no point in checking for a BRAF mutation. You can stop and save that money. Well, on the other hand, if it's cheaper to do them both at once, maybe the economics, you know, maybe it's more efficient to do it that way, even though a third of the tests were unnecessary. So, you know, it's tricky. People say it's sort of analogous to the days of if you just wanted a platelet count, you ordered just a platelet count. No one does that. Everyone orders a complete blood count now. It's part of a package. If you just want platelets, you get the whole bundle. It's the same $4. So, you know, we're trying to work that out. And I think it'll evolve as there are more drug target pairs. With respect to prior authorization, I'll just say the following. There is nothing that physicians hate more in day-to-day practice than prior authorizations. And I'll just provide the perspective of we understand why it has to be. And to a great extent, it's our own fault, right? Not only our fault, but we are certainly culpable for having created this need for prior authorizations. It's not that you know, we're all taxpaying members of the public, or we should be, and so we understand the rationale for it. But when you're in clinic and there are 15 sick people in your waiting room with 11 different insurance providers, and, you know, somebody has time in the chair, and their nurse is like, where's Mr. Smith? He was supposed to be in the chair at 2 o'clock. Where's the order? And you're like, I can't write the order. We don't have prior off. And you got a waiting room and a fax machine, and you can't get them on the phone, and, you know, you're on hold. It doesn't work well. I mean, it's just a very hard way to run a busy oncology practice. And the truth is, really what we end up managing is the psychiatric meltdown of the patient and their spouse, and all the phone calls from the son in California who call you up screaming at you that you can't manage to deliver something that they had been counting on and hadn't slept on. So it's cumbersome, and I think we really have to do a better job working together, at least to streamline the prior auth process or to make it run smoother. And I think that the key is actually working with the pharmaceutical manufacturers at the time so that when we use this product, this is what it's approved for, this is what it's not approved for, having sort of consistent forms across payers, a lingua franca, because every patient has a different provider and a different set of forms and a different 1-800 number. It just, the system could be better. And, you know, someone's going to figure out there's a little niche business model in there to make this all work. I haven't quite seen it work yet, but someone's going to figure out that there's this key functionality that could be streamlined.
So I sort of wanted to ask a question related to both of that, and that's sort of, can you give us a feel for how the reality is working on these? There was a paper sometime back on the use of Herceptin test and how there were many patients getting Herceptin who didn't get a Herceptin test, and it was a staggering number. So tell us the reality today. Are you getting 80, 90% compliance, or is it still 50%?
Yeah, I just asked one of my colleagues to pull the data on that, because I haven't refreshed the data on that in about 3 years. But absolutely, I mean, there was a time where the amount of, if you looked at the Herceptin test or any Herceptin testing and you looked at the dispensing of Herceptin, that it was probably only about 40, 50% of people who were dispensed Herceptin who ever had a HER2 new test. I think that situation is still there. It's gotten a lot better. I think it was one of the first examples of companion diagnostics, and so now we have a lot more examples. The more that we have, the more it just becomes part of clinical practice. So it's getting a lot better, and now I need to refresh it to get the accurate data today. I think that you know, what we've done now with Zelbref and what we've done with Xalkori are the first times that we've put in place prior authorizations around testing. At Medco, at least. And so I think that that will also greatly improve this. We also have other testing programs at Medco where we offer, through MolecularMD, you know, BCR-ABLE testing for monitoring. And so I think that the more that the payers get engaged with making sure that the tests are used and used appropriately, the more that that gap in care will be closed. So it's getting better.
So I just want to say, I think actually on the provider side, we are also trying to do things so that we don't even have to deal with this. And the way we're doing that is instead of having it be this free-for-all, so everyone's, or most people are trying to have computer, electronic medical record order entry system so that you're ordering your chemotherapy electronically. Well, now you have to say what regimen you're going to give, and essentially the computer will not let it go through. Just the same as, you know, your credit card. If it's your credit card and you punch in one number wrong, Amazon's not going to let you buy the book, or you can't get it if you put something in that's not standard. So it's not going to take an order for Herceptin without documentation of the HER2-NU. And it pops up. It shows you there's no documented HER2. You know, you have to have it in there, the date, the test, so that we are bypassing this through the order entry system and then going back to our big payers, depending on your market, and saying, hey, Blue Cross, hey, Aetna, look, we have the following approved regimens for breast cancer. You know, we've added HER2 for our gastric cancer, but you can only order Herceptin for gastric cancer if you've had this test. Otherwise, you can't even order it. So it's a little bit less Wild West free-for-all, and maybe instead of, you know, 100 patients having 60 regimens, you have 100 patients having 15 regimens. without really compromising care in any meaningful way. I mean, some might disagree, but I think the order entry really has helped.
It has helped, but I will say one thing, that we used that system for a while, and all that system requires is somebody put a date in about when that test was done. When we went to the system that we actually asked for the results to be faxed to us, all of a sudden the rate of testing we saw went way down, because it was just, oh, if I have to put a date in to get this drug dispensed that I want to, the date was inserted, whether the test was done or not.
So you're saying we cheat. We're monkeys. Probably, except, you know, there are ways, I mean, yes, it's like you give people a test and they'll find a way around it, but there are ways of enforcing that, you know, actually requiring. You can address that.
All right, so we have
Hi, I have a different question, right? So to what extent is the real-world comparative effectiveness research data is going to drive payer formulary decision-making or medical policy decision-making, right? So do you envision that to be happening? If so, when? And can you give some examples? And also, what is the pharmaco going to do about that? So all three panelists. Thank you.
Well, I think that's an interesting question. The first thing is that in terms of the impact, we're far behind in oncology, because for other therapeutic areas, they've gone above and beyond that. And in mental health, in cardiovascular and all other therapeutic areas, the lead diabetes, there are actual guidance documents and methodological frameworks that are being utilized at the payer level. In oncology, the main issue is that you have the real-world data, but you don't have the tools. You don't have that rich clinical information to stratify your population at the genomic and at the phenomic level. And that's the main issue, because for comparative effectiveness, there is so much heterogeneity in your patient population, trial design, as well as the outcomes. So when you go back to the real world, there are very limited real-world databases that have rich EMR information. Most of the time, we are dealing with claims databases, and those claims databases are not basically inherently designed for research. They're designed for claim management. So EMR capability is developing amongst the payers as well as other research organizations. The more that capability develops, the more precision we would have in our estimates as well as our methodological guidelines and frameworks, and the more we'll be able to create an impact. But we're not talking weeks or months. It's going to take years. It's a phase-wise process. The first most important thing is the broad-based application of EMRs across different patient populations in oncology that we are talking about. The second aspect is the ability and the capability to mine that data in the best, precise, and the most standardized way to from a methodological standpoint. So data mining, that's the second phase. And then third is the dissemination of the data and peer-reviewed impact around that. So there are three phases, and I think it would take years in creating a real-world impact on an aggregate level.
I don't know if I fully understood the question, but the qualities that Usman talked about, that NICE uses, we use similar type of information, but what we're really looking at is a cost per quality. And what we're going to see is the cost is not just the drug cost, but it's also the cost to patient care. So as Usman said, if somebody has 3 extra months of overall survival, but that 3 months of overall survival is constantly being in the hospital, getting imaged, getting sick, having toxic events, and costs even more money, it's not great quality of life for the patient, and it's also not good cost per quality for the payers. And so we look at the claims data, which is actually the actual costs that we're paying, over the length of time that patients are surviving, and looking at that endpoint, and then making decisions about where is it working and where is it not. We talked yesterday in the data about how does it work correctly, and then we can create these protocol-based medicines that Deborah was talking about and put those into place. So that's how we're looking at it. I think one of the other interesting things to note in the U.S. healthcare population, which is very different from Europe and other socialized medicine countries, is that the largest payer of health bills within the United States is employers, not CMS, but actually employers. And therefore, what they're looking for when they come to us is that their benefit design is not just how much money am I spending, but also what's happening to my workforce. How can I get people to show up at work, be present at work? And so if what you're really saying is somebody's going to be out of work a lot longer, cost a lot more, and ultimately not have a significant increase in overall survival, that's maybe not a benefit from their perspective. And so we have to start looking at that. Again, we haven't really looked at it in oncology, but now that everybody's focused on oncology and that specialty is the highest increase in trend, not spend, but where the money's starting to go, that there's a higher and higher focus from the payers in the United States on oncology. Oh, absolutely. So once there's actually multiple me toos, as I will call them, in the same class of drugs, then it's going to definitely be a formulary decision that's based upon our negotiated price over those drugs. And then also right now we're looking at biosimilars. A lot of the drugs in oncology are going generic, so the pricing is very decreasing on certain current standard of care therapies. So you're going to have to beat not just the standard of care significantly, but then your cost compared to a generic and biosimilar market. So we're definitely looking at that.
Brian? Hi, over here. Yeah. I have a question about getting test results faxed to you before you authorize Zelboraf or Zelcori. So are you looking to see if there's a test and the test is appropriately positive? Or are you looking to see if it was a test that's FDA approved per drug label? And the corollary to that is if you're not, since there are these panels, which I think we all think are important to be developing, are you doing a coverage with evidence kind of approach? How do you see that evolving?
So those are two questions. I'll take the first one first. We're not the FDA, so we're agnostic to which test was run, whether it was an LDT or the FDA-approved test. We're just looking to see that the test was run and that it was positive for a treatment decision because we don't want to disrupt care. I think Deborah would probably be even more upset if I said, oh, thank you for the test results, but it was not the right test that you ran. So I don't think we're at that stage yet. But at the same time, we're trying to work with Roche and Abbott and MolecularMD and Dako and QIAGEN and everybody else to say, you know, if we're doing a proactive program, we want to support the test that was actually FDA approved. And at other panels that I speak on, I often say that one of the biggest issues I see about molecular medicine and companion diagnostics in oncology is that the deals are done to get regulatory approval. They're not really done to actually get the patient tested and the patient the drug. You don't see any TV advertisements for your BRAF test or your KRAS test. You know, those are not on television because there's no support from pharma on the marketing of the diagnostic. It's only the marketing of the drug. And I think that they have to truly be companions. And I absolutely believe that if pharma focused on correct utilization and promotion of the diagnostic testing up front, that would actually help them achieve their ROIs and their projections for their market instead of just focusing on what they're traditionally good at, which is marketing drugs and not diagnostics.
I'd like to point out the pharma perspective on that, and I think because it's really important that you pointed out, Brian, and that's an area of research that is going to be focused on in the next few years because it's important that we should have the ability to guide the stakeholders in terms of molecular diagnostic and companion diagnostic, but what are the appropriate methods through which we can actually guide that? That's still a question. And in that perspective, there's a symposium that's coming up on May the 23rd that's going to be headed by the CMTP. That's Center for Center for Medical Technology Policy. It's going to be headed by Sean Tunis, the former CMO of CMS. And we're basically they're bringing all the payers, the pharma, as well as the method experts. The symposium is specifically centered on developing a methodological framework to assess the clinical utility of molecular and companion diagnostics. So we have started working on that in collaboration with other stakeholders. There's going to be an effectiveness guidance document as part of that symposium that's going to be released by the end of the year for comment from all the stakeholders. And we hope to get a consensus approach on certain cancers within the next 5 years on molecular diagnostics and use of biomarker assessment.
So just to follow up on that, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm from Pfizer. So at any rate, do you have concerns in low-incidence disease? Because we all want to get the right drug to the right patient in the easiest fashion possible. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through to get the diagnostic approved. And in that setting, if you have a diagnostic with a 95% specificity, mm-hmm. You could be missing half of the potential patient population. So how the test actually performs, I think, is important. And mm-hmm. I would encourage you, if you're taking just give me the test results mm-hmm. Approach, that you monitor in some way, is this a Foundation Medicine test? What kinds of tests were done? Because you may find that there are some big problems with some of the tests. You may find they're better than the approved tests. But you need to answer that question as well.
So related to that is the business model for diagnostic companies. If you're reimbursing equally the lab-based test and the FDA-approved test, it's awfully hard for the diagnostic developer to go to the pharma company and say, you have to pay me big bucks to make this test, when somebody else is going to get the value and they don't need you.
So most of the diagnostic deals that are done around companion diagnostics are what I'll call a fee-for-service type deal. And they're high value to the kit companies, as I like to call them, who make the kits that can be shipped anywhere around the world and globally distributed. And all the revenues that they make come from regulatory success, because that's the real goal of the pharma company, is to get their drug approved in every market. And if a diagnostic is needed because the FDA tells them that it has to be needed and it has to be FDA approved because the drug's FDA approved, then what the pharma company is doing is just paying the company enough money to get all that done and have a business. I don't really believe that there's been enough evidence that after the drug is launched that what the diagnostic company is really hoping for is the revenues that they're going to make on selling those tests. So I wish it was. But the problem, again, comes to the coding system. Again, right now, almost all those diagnostics go through the medical benefit. And even whether you're a kid or not, you're limited in your reimbursement to procedures that you use to do that assay, and not through the value that assay brings to patients. And so, again, those business models those business deals are not done through a revenue. So yeah, it is a problem. And that's why we work with the companies to give a value-based diagnostic approach and a value-based reimbursement. And that's why our deals with diagnostic companies at Medco are with one company that offers one test so that they can get that full value.
So one thing we haven't directly addressed yet, this is really for everyone, is so we talk about prior authorization, but a number of the pilots being done on clinical pathways. I'd like to hear some commentary about that. We've talked about the kind of the increasing pressures around compendia listing. You already talked about kind of maybe you won't have 60 options. You might have 15 options that are laid out. I can think of lots of financial pros. I can think of some potential clinical cons to not having the ability to kind of mix and match in the old-fashioned way, the kind of real-world experimenting that has occurred, because that does lead to some interesting discoveries. But I'd like to kind of get some thoughts from the three different perspectives about, where we'll go, when we'll really have kind of implementation of clinical pathways, whether we'll really get to a, some type of capitated type of environment.
From a pharma perspective, I think what we think is that clinical pathways is going to be, it's probably in the near future they might apply in the compendium and all that, but the way the landscape is moving, and there are two perspectives. One is the European perspective and one is the U.S. perspective. Within the U.S., what's happening right now is we're more leaning towards a capitated environment and an issue called bundling, the same aspect that was done by CMS and others in renal. So what we're anticipating is a bundling phenomena where you'll be given a specific amount of, where products with the same MOA or the same profile are all going to be bundled together in specific categories, and the oncologist would be paid a specific amount per patient to manage within those pool of the products. United Healthcare just, and I think Brian can comment on that, they must have some assessment going on at their end. United Healthcare embarked on a pilot study last year focusing on 5 different cancers, and that's the bundling project that they have initiated, and the outcome of that would be to get the right amount of data to basically be able to bundle these similar products into one category and then apply a capitated amount to the patients. At the European level, they've gone more advanced than that. What they've done is that they've put the ball back into the pharma's court, and it's called risk sharing. So in the U.S., what we've done so far is just contracting based on pricing, and pricing is based on volume, the volume discounts. But in Europe, what's happening is that we actually get into contracts with the payers based on risk sharing, and risk sharing is based on outcomes. So based on just to give you a very simple example, based on our data, if we claim that certain proportion of patients would have a progression-free survival by this point, if that doesn't happen, and we're claiming about 40% of the patients would have that at the end in that patient population, it happens in 35% of the patient population, then we'll be covering that that margins that the payer is losing at their end for the claims that we made and that didn't happen. So that is called risk sharing, and that is happening at the global level outside the U.S. So there are two different trajectories where we're moving. Within the U.S., it's certainly going towards a capitated environment, where a certain amount of money per patient based on certain amount of data, and globally it's a more sophisticated approach based on value based outcomes and pricing and risk sharing strategies.
I'll just comment on that then. We tried capitated care, back in the 80s. It didn't work, because it incentivized the physician not to see any patients so that they could make as much money off of not seeing patients than treating patients, to be kind of cynical about that. So we moved more towards a fee for procedures, and then that drove, especially outside of oncology, drove physicians to doing a lot of procedures that they make money off of, whether it was really a benefit to the patient or not. So now we're moving back to a capitated care model where it's driven by patient outcomes, which I think is a very good model. But I would say that what you've seen by UHG or United Healthcare around their capitated care model for oncology reimbursement was not driven to control costs due to overutilization, which is what we see in most other therapeutic areas, but it was driven due to the buy and bill problem where large infusion clinics and physicians groups were making significant revenue off of particular drugs that they were administering, and therefore maybe were administering those drugs more often than the patient should have been getting, because that's where they were making more revenue. And so what UHG is piloting now is saying, let me give you a certain amount of money for the number of patients that you treat with oncology that covers what the average costs are of the various different drug based upon our prevalence of how those drugs should be used, and therefore you're going to manage those costs. I hope the results are very good, but just by Brian DiCaro impression, not Medco impression of what will happen, is that maybe physicians will want to see the patients that need the lower cost drugs so that they can earn more money, and that if a patient comes in that maybe is more relevant for a higher cost therapeutic, that maybe those patients need to go to a different physician. And I don't know if that will pan out, but then I guess my own personal cynical view of what might happen in that type of model. So we'll wait and see. It's not an easy solution for any of these problems. I think that what's happening in Europe, risk sharing is probably a better approach to controlling costs on the pharmaceutical drug side.
Comments? So, I know we're getting late on time.
Yeah, so just briefly, I mean, these are obviously complicated problems with no one solution. I think we know that compendia are not the solution. They may be part of the solution, but for a long time, compendia have just been licensed to do whatever you want, and that needs to change. Clinical pathways are great, and they may take you from a parameter space of 100 down to 20, but that in and of itself is not enough. But I think getting oncologists out of the position of selling drugs and making a profit on selling drugs, so that buy and bill model, that's something that certainly oncologists who work in large organizations or academic practices, they're already on board, U.S. Oncology, et cetera. But increasingly oncologists in, you know, small private community practices want to be out of that. There's an inherent conflict. You know, I think for a long time, the drug subsidy reimbursed the actual care, which is the hour and a half that you sit with someone who's approaching the end of their life trying to help them make good decisions, for which you got $72. And so you have this funny cross-subsidization system, and that needs to be fixed. And I think, you know, providers agree. It's just a question, how are we going to get there without repeating all the pitfalls of capitation that no one wants to repeat? You know, United Healthcare may not have gotten their experiment exactly right, but the idea of bundling and risk sharing and having physicians have some skin in the game without cheating the high-risk complicated patient out of necessary care, you know, striking that sweet spot, perfect balance, that's really what we're preoccupied with. I think right now we're really busy trying to figure out how the government's accountable care organizations, which really applies to primary care, how is that going to impact us in sort of the specialty world of oncology? And we're in the middle of trying to figure that out.
Jeff, can I just make one? Yes, sorry, I just want to make one comment about protocol-driven medicine. I actually think it's very good, but I think you have to have a grace period. You have to have a period of time where the drug is used and by physicians after it's launched in various different ways to monitor what the right schedule, what the right dosing, what the right sequence is. As we heard yesterday, I think by allowing that to occur and that experimenting that can't happen, we've seen right now, due to the costs of developing the drugs during drug development, I think you can actually let the data tell you what the right protocol is. I would be a little bit worried that we might settle on a protocol just based upon a clinical study, which now is not the actual protocol that will benefit the patients who weren't part of that clinical study. So I think there needs to be a rational way of observing for a period and then setting protocols and adjusting them.
And sharing information in some way, whether that's crowdsourcing the favored moment or...
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. We're up at tight pressure here, so we can get Dr. McClellan on. So, again, I appreciate the panelists, and certainly feel free to circle back with the panelists. Thank you.